You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams. You know, it's a mother-son thing.
Yeah.
The show is like mother, like son?
Yes. That's right, with the question mark.
With a question mark.
Live from the pit at the Palace Theater and on a cell phone is our esteemed guest, Jason DeBoard, the keyboardist for Lestat. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son. This is my mom, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams. Have you ever wondered what it's like to be a Broadway musician and what goes on down there in the pit, the orchestra pit, that is, where everyone is dressed in black? Well, today we're joined by musician Jason DeBoard, who actually is in the orchestra pit because he's currently playing keyboard for the new Broadway show, Lestat. Jason's also paid his dues, touring as music director with the smash hit You're in Town and also played for Bat Boy. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son, Jason.
Thanks for having me, Patricia and Ramsey. I appreciate it.
And I really thank you for taking time today to have us call you, even though you have two shows, starting with the matinee in about a couple of hours.
Yeah. I'm actually talking to you from the pit of the live from the pit of the Palace Theater.
Okay, that seems totally appropriate. You know, I first want to ask you about the two plays, Bat Boy and Lestat. Now, they're similar in that they're both about bats and vampires. And doing this show with Mark and Ramsey, I'm learning a lot actually about using my computer. I didn't really know anything about Bat Boy, so I Googled it, and when it came up, I was really interested in what came on the screen, which was that no bats were harmed in the making of this musical, and it was also advertised as another bloody musical. But as we know, Lestat is also about vampires, and is it just by chance that you are involved with these two bloody shows, or is this a special interest of yours?
It just seemed to happen that way. It's very funny. Bat Boy was my first real show that I did in New York as a regular, you know, as it being my chair, where I originated the chair. I started out as the keyboard two player on that show, and then took over as music director and conductor after a few months. But what's interesting about actually both shows is that they both have this vampiric kind of theme to them, but they're actually about characters and situations that don't necessarily have anything to do with that theme, but that just happened to be the story vehicle for both of them in very different ways.
Well, that brings up my something. I heard an interview with Annie Rice, who wrote the interview with the vampire, and as a parent, I was absolutely moved by this because I understand she had a child who had leukemia, and she said she was just obsessed with blood for a number of years because her child had a blood disease, and she wrote her first book a year after this child died. And so in some ways, I guess parents or anybody can get really moved to artistic production through such a tragedy, and that was the beginning of Annie Rice's famous series of novels.
A lot of the story of Lestat is about the relationship between Lestat and his mother, and it's a story in a lot of ways about letting parents letting children go, children letting parents go find their own way, and even if that way is going to be difficult or requires you being apart for a while, about how we grow as people. And the difference with Lestat is that he never dies, so it goes on for a really long time for him. And how does he deal with that? And how does she deal with that?
So the whole time they're trying to separate, but it never ends.
Yeah, because they both can live forever. And so how do they as living beings come to terms with that? And that's one of the main not the only, but one of the main stories in the show. And it's a really compelling story, and it's the reason I think so many people have been attracted to the story over time.
Jason, I want to come back to Lestat in a minute, but first I want to talk about Bat Boy. My mom here said she Googled Bat Boy because she'd never heard of it. I think she probably microfiched it, not Googled it.
I don't know what that means.
But, you know, Bat Boy was a huge hit. I don't know how you could, you know, I don't know if you slept through the millennium or something. I mean, that was like a huge, one of the biggest Broadway musicals. It was off-Broadway, right?
Yeah, it was off-Broadway.
But, I mean, it was like a cult hit. I mean, it was everywhere. The posters were everywhere. I mean, that was like a big deal. And you were the musical director, right?
I started out as the key two player, and as the assistant music director, and then our music director left for other projects, and then I moved up to the music director position and closed the show as music director.
And did that was sort of a launching pad to get you onto this? I mean, this is such a huge gig that you've got now. I mean, in my opinion, I don't think you, as a keyboardist, you could get a bigger, better gig. Maybe playing for the Who or something, but.
It's pretty nice, man. I mean, I have to say that when they hired me for the job, that there was this initial moment of, oh dear, I have to play the piano part on an Elton John show. and he gets to listen to me play it. Oh, wow, okay.
Is he actively engaged and involved in this? I mean, he must be, right? It's his...
Absolutely. He has to do it because he also has his touring schedule to keep up. And so he has his music director on the road is our music supervisor for the show, a gentleman named Guy Babylon. Guy plays keys for Elton on the road. Guy goes between Elton and us and basically acts as kind of the conduit for what Elton's writing and what he wants to be done in the show. And then our music director, Brad Hawk, institutes those changes and. It's kind of a long distance relationship, but it's a very active relationship.
Yeah, I understand that there were a certain amount of rewriting and revising with Bernie Taupin and Elton John. Were you any part of that, or do you just get the finished product?
I'm not really part of the rewriting process. I'm more kind of the hands-on, more of the we pretty much executed on this end.
Right.
Bernie and Elton and Guy and Brad really. Are the ones that collaborated on what the changes are that needed to happen between San Francisco and New York, and then we do the footwork. Then that's where our music team here then puts it to the pavement. You know,
yeah. Right. You interpret it. How's that?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So speaking of those interpretations, this is Mark Sutton, the producer here, and. Let's listen to some music. Why don't you tell us a little about? We're going to listen to the piece Right Before My Eyes. I think that's one of the prettiest pieces from the show. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Absolutely. Right Before My Eyes is a song that was written between San Francisco and New York, between our production there and production here. It's a song that Lestat, who's played by Hugh Pinero, sings to his best friend Nicholas, who he's considering, do I want to take him and make him one of my kind, a vampire as well, so we can, be together through time. That's what the song is about. It's about a friendship, it's about a relationship, and how he's coming to terms with himself.
All right, and here it is, from the musical Lestat, Right Before My Eyes, music by Elton John, lyrics by Bernie Taupin.
And so my conscience speaks to me of selfishness and consequence, the danger that from death I'd make, a stolen soul no longer blessed with innocence. But such a kingdom could be ours, a wondrous world beyond compare. Would his bright fire not wish it so? Surely he'd agree this gift is one that should be shared. So why do I go back and forth? What is this doubt that clouds my thoughts? Don't waste the chance and let the night pass by. He's mine to take. He's right before my eyes. Everything I really need is standing here in front of me. That my heart should not deny is out of reach, right before my eyes, is out of reach, but right before my eyes.
We're talking with Jason DeBoard on Like Mother, Like Son.
Tell me how you learned to play keyboard. It's sort of an interesting instrument in the sense that, piano is the classical one, and keyboard nowadays is you know, an instrument that is so complicated. There's so many options. I mean, what does it mean to play keyboard now with a computer giving you 8 billion different sound choices and your ambidextrous feet, both hands and feet going at the same time?
You mean keyboards have computers? I didn't even know that.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, it's a actually, when you turn on our instrument at work, it's not, you know, it used to be, even if you were playing a synthesizer in an orchestra pit, you know, you turn it on and the sounds are there. We have disk drives connected to our keyboards. They have to go through a boot sequence, just like your computer does, only it takes a little bit longer. You know, like your PC or your Mac at home.
Is he lost you here already? Patricia's got this look on her face. Like, you lost her 5 minutes ago with it, like booting on the PC, blah blah blah. Like she.
It's just like turning on it. It's just like turning on a computer, only it takes a little longer.
Well, Mark suggested it was like being in the cockpit of an airplane, which sounds pretty confusing to me.
Not unlike it. We try to make it streamlined. The process of putting it together is very complicated. Once you get into the performance of the show, we have it down to the point where you can just advance through these different setups. So basically all you're doing is playing, but you have different foot controls that advance the sounds in the computer, so you don't actually have to go in and monkey with it very much.
So just admit it, Jason, you're using the orchestrator thingy, right? That one where you don't need any other musicians anymore, it's just you press the button?
Thankfully, no. We have 19 live musicians down here in the pit. And three of them are keyboardists, but a lot of them, those keyboards are creating textures and sounds that you can't create with any other instrument. We have samples of children's choir, British children's choirs.
Yeah, really?
Are they union?
And all kinds of ethnic instruments and ethnic percussion instruments that our percussionists play that, you know, we couldn't get our hands on, but these machines let us create those sounds along with the sound of a live string section and live woodwinds and brass.
As a parent, I have a question about your background and your training and whether or not you had to get over the resistance of parents who didn't think that you should go into the music world, or whether they were always supportive of this effort that you've made. And of course, now you're a great success at a very young age, so I'm sure they're very proud. But
they are. They're great. My parents are great. Patricia, I was really lucky because I come from a family of musicians. My grandparents were all musicians, not on my father's side, but on my mother's side. And I basically learned by being around them. I don't remember a time when I didn't play. I was always able to sit with my brothers and play music and sit with my grandparents and play music.
What instruments did they play?
My grandfather was a drummer and also a music educator. He taught all the band instruments. My grandmother was a pianist.
Okay.
And my great uncle played the saw, and my mother was a singer. My great aunt was a singer. My grandparents had a band actually up until they were in their 70s.
Does the guy who plays the saw professionally have a card with the little saw on it that he hands out at gigs?
They definitely should have one.
Is this interest of your grandparents and influence on you led you to Lawrence Welk?
I grew up watching Lawrence Welk with my grandparents, and it was really when in Southern California, the live music scene really, you know, kind of shrank as time has gone on, sadly. And one of the only full-time jobs for musicians was working at the Lawrence Welk Resort Theater, which is north of San Diego in a place called Escondido. And when I was 21 years old, a keyboard position became available, and they hired me.
I find it just amazing that you did that, because I still think of, you know, Lawrence Welk in the 50s as totally square music with his champagne bubbles and that sort of, and accordions and that kind of thing. And I understand it's become sort of popular again among your generation.
Yeah, it kind of has. When I started working there, it was really more of a dinner theater, more just doing, you know, like Rodgers and Hammerstein and Jerome Kern shows and things like that. And then as time went on, they started bringing the Welk stars back and doing these more kind of variety shows, you know, a la Ed Sullivan or your show of shows kind of thing. We played dog acts. I played a magic act where a guy pulled light bulbs out of his mouth.
Sounds great.
Hey, Jason, this might be a little like asking a magician what his tricks are, but you're in the pit. You're playing keyboard. I would imagine that you're maybe the leading instrument in the sense that you're setting the tempo for a lot of other of the 19 other musicians who are following, and also the performers on stage. You know, they have little microphones, right, attached to their faces, and they can't see you, and they're probably not looking at a conductor.
In the stat, we actually in the stat we do have a conductor. Actually, we do have a conductor at the podium, and he really kind of sets the tone and keeps things together. But it's really my job to, like you said, in this show, because it's not really a drum and bass driven show. It's more, it has more of a traditional musical theater kind of a Les Mis kind of feel to it. Les Miserables kind of feel to the show, and so the piano is instrumental in guiding the singers as well. So it's really a conversation, a visual conversation between the conductor and I and the singers in a lot of ways.
You mean through the conductor? Because you don't, do you see the singers?
No, I don't see, right. In the pit, you don't see anything on stage.
Right.
All you see is, as I'm literally standing down here right now, all I have are black walls around me, and I'm sitting right next to the podium where I can see the conductor. And we also have, every player in the pit has a little, our little 21st century take on it, is everyone also has a little television monitor, very small, near their music stand. So if they're in a position where they don't have a good view of the conductor, you can always look at the TV and see him.
So it's a picture of the conductor, not the stage.
Correct. It's just a picture of the conductor. Hmm. And then, and as you said, the singers all have very small, very high-tech mics that are usually planted in their wig toward the forehead area. And they're crystal clear, excellent microphones. And that's what helps to provide amplification for houses, because the palace, this theater, is about 1,900 seats. It's big.
Jason, I got a question about those mics. When did those things start getting used? I've seen those in a few different shows. They're very popular. They sound great. But, you know, if you're sitting in the front couple rows, you can really see them. And they look, I don't know, I get reminded of, like, I don't know, it has an interesting look. Let's put
like
it that way.
A Q-tip?
Yeah, it almost looks like a Q-tip sticking out of their wig.
You can see them, yeah. And it also depends on the show, and it depends on who's kind of in charge of concealing them. Some shows you can see them more than others. Some shows you can't see them at all. It just depends on kind of who's designed the little magic there that goes on how they can. There are ways they can conceal them.
They replace the hanging mics that used to be. I mean, this is relative. Or does it mean that people don't have to sing as loudly, or throw?
A lot of it has to do with the way that music is amplified now. A lot of the instruments that we're using in orchestra pits now are amplified instruments. They have to. You're not just hearing the music acoustically; you're hearing it amplified through a sound system, and so the human voice can't compete with that. And so, there needs to be support. They started using mics, and around the time of Chorus Line is really when they started. Back in the mid-70s is when they started using microphones, I believe. I might be wrong on this. But they used to have hanging mics and also what were called foot mics at the foot of the stage.
Do they use these mics in opera or only Broadway?
No, they do not use mics. Well, I take that back. They generally don't use them in opera. I believe in some theaters, I might be wrong, but I think at the New York State Theater, sometimes they use a little reinforcement because that theater was designed for ballet, which is designed to deaden the sound of the theater. So, they may use a little reinforcement. But overall, opera is done live. Like at the Met, what you're hearing is the actual sound of the voices and the instruments.
Hey, Jason, let me step back to the process, because it just fascinates me so much. Like, as you explained, your instrument, the keyboard, is so diverse. There's so many choices. There's so many different things that you can do. Yet these are songs that are written by Elton John. I can't imagine that you don't play a very large creative role in deciding how to interpret your instrument, considering how versatile it is. I mean, they're not writing it for your specific keyboard and your specific choices, right? I mean, that's...
Really, my I would say there is some room for interpretation with a key one book. Keyboard One is kind of the name of the book that I play. And there's definitely some points where not everything is spelled out for you on the page. And it's your job as a musician at that point, as a keyboardist, to say, I know the style that the music calls for here, and I'm going to create that. And so there is a creative, with certain boundaries on it, there is a bit of creativity involved in knowing how to make something, help something reach its destination.
I would disagree with Ramsey on in his question here, because just listening to you talk about what the play was about relationships and separation, and the almost the passion with which you spoke of that told me right then that you were interpreting this music through what was going on stage, I would think.
Absolutely. It has to drive... What happens on stage is what has to indicate the music. That our job ultimately is storytelling, and that's through the music. The music is supporting what's happening on the stage. We're there to serve the story, and it's never really fully about the song. You know, it's never totally about the song or totally about the scene. It's all about telling a story, and what we all are doing is telling a story, and that's the point of what we're doing down here.
All right. So speaking of telling a story, let's go to let's listen to one more piece. Jason, why don't you? This is Au Choix. You get to choose between "Sail Me Away," "Make Me As You Are," or "Welcome to the New World."
Oh, let's listen to a little bit of "Welcome to the New World." That's a fun tune.
All right. Here we go. Why don't you tell us about it real quick?
This is the opening of Act Two, and this is another song that was a totally different style when we did our show in San Francisco, and we completely reconceived it for the New York production. This is when Lestat arrives in New Orleans.
All right. Welcome to the New World from the musical Lestat. Like Mother, Like Son with Ramsey and Patricia Adams. Our guest tonight, Jason DeBoard from the musical Lestat.
Reviewers have also talked about the homoerotic quality of the play and a possible homosexual theme. And it's just interesting how often those two themes go together. I'm not making any broad psychological statement.
Broadway
what
show?
Two themes? Broadway and
homosexuality never go together.
No, mother, son, and homosexuality.
Yeah, not at all.
You know, we were talking about Lawrence Welk and about how popular he's become. And I actually remembered Mark Sutton talked about how cool he thought the accordion player was. Mark, tell me again.
Well, the thing that's amazing about the Lawrence Welk show is that the performers, no matter how difficult the music they play, they always have this great smile, stage smile on their face. And they could be playing, you know, the hardest piece of music you've ever heard, and they're playing it perfectly, and they're looking right in the camera and smiling like they're posing for their high school yearbook photo. Did they tell you to do that when you were there?
You know, we didn't have to very much because we were down in the pit most of the time for the musicals. But toward the end of my tenure, they put us up on stage, which was interesting because I when you sign up to work in a pit and all of a sudden they put you on stage, it's like, oh, my job description changed.
You've moved up, literally.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you have to grin a little more. Which after the 10th Christmas show of the week can get a little tiring.
So, is that an advantage of being in the pit on Broadway? You can sort of relax. You're not. Nobody's actually looking at you.
Absolutely. It's more. In a way, it's more like going to the office. If that makes any sense. There's an anonymity to it that I actually enjoy. That you go in and you're kind of the man behind the curtain. You get to create something you get to entertain people, you get to create something neat and interesting and fun and wonderful, but you get to kind of come in, do it in secret, and then go out and kind of live your life. I kind of enjoy that.
Hey, we're going to let you go soon because it's we know that you got a matinee to do and you're busy and we've taken up a lot of your time already. But I got one sort of question. I'm a lefty, and I'm always wanted to be a famous rock star. And I picked up a righty guitar, and I blame my leftiness and my righty guitar on me not being a big, huge, famous rock star. Are you ambidextrous? How do you possibly play a keyboard? I mean, can you hit a ball with swinging lefty and righty? I mean, in baseball, are you?
You know what? I'm really not. I'm very right-handed. There are a couple things I do kind of backwards. I eat left-handed. I use a shovel left-handed, but other than that, I do everything right-handed. And I favor my right hand and my pink as well.
Do you do a lot of shoveling?
Not lately.
All right, well, Jason, you mentioned you like the anonymity of the pit, but now you're world famous because you've been on Like Mother, Like Son. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my gosh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, you guys.
Thanks so much, Jason, for joining us.
Congratulations. It's really amazing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited about it.
Just heard music from Lestat with the keyboardist Jason DeBoard.
You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. This is my mother, Patricia Adams. I'm Ramsey Adams. And then our producer in the studio with us is Mark Sutton.
To hear more of Jason's music, check him out on the web at www.jasondeboard.com. And check out our website while you're at it. We're at www.likemotherlikeson.org. Good night.